For argument, Brown versus Rios, Ms. Cox.
May it please the Court, Your Honor, Melissa Cox, appointed counsel for appellant petitioner Carnell Brown. Mr. Brown's ACCA enhanced sentence should be vacated for three primary reasons. First, his prior conviction for pandering by compulsion under Illinois law is not a violent felony under the ACCA's residual clause because that crime does not involve categorically purposeful conduct as required by Begay. Second,
what does it involve? I haven't been able to find out what compelling means in this statute.
Your Honor, the question of...
There seem to be any cases. Are there cases?
The case law is scant, Your Honor.
Do you say scant? Is there a case somewhere I could look at?
Your Honor, there are cases we found in approximately 1912 regarding compulsion. Maybe 1920.
The statute was different.
That's correct, Your Honor. It was.
What about under the current statute or the current definition of compelling, whatever that is?
Your Honor, in my research, I believe I found two cases. Both of those cases were two published cases, both of which did include compulsion that would have been physical. Although we submit, Your Honor, that what matters under the categorical approach is whether the elements of the statute require intentional compulsion.
Well, okay, and that depends on what compulsion means or compelling means. That's what I can't figure out.
Your Honor, the statute here does not include the statute at issue under which Mr. Brown was prosecuted, which has since been repealed. That statute did not include an express mental state element, although the legislative...
That's been repealed? I don't understand.
Your Honor, the statute under which, the pandering statute under which Mr. Brown was convicted in 1984 is no longer on the books in Illinois. The provisions have been transferred into a new statute, Your Honor. We don't cite the new statute in our brief, but it's called promoting prostitution. And we would note, however, that that new statute does expressly include a knowledge element, which was absent from the prior statute under which Mr. Brown was convicted. And we do know from looking at the legislative history, of course, that this type of
What is the sentence range under the new statute?
Your Honor, the sentence range, it's still a Class 4 felony as it was under the prior, if that's your question.
Is that still 1 to 3 years?
Yes, Your Honor. My understanding is that it is.
They changed the punishment, but they changed the definition. Do they still have compelling and arranging as two separate crimes?
Yes, Your Honor. There are two, and there's an additional prong, which is advances prostitution. And I haven't researched the case law to see how advances has been found in the case law. I mean, we would note that.
So, all right, what do you think is the? It's ridiculous. It must be they ignore compelling because arranging is easier to prove. Is that it? Is that why there are no cases, or there are no arranging cases either?
Your Honor, there are many arranging cases.
So they're not bothering with compelling because they have to prove more, and there's no higher punishment range.
Your Honor, the lack of compulsion cases in the published case law is consistent with our proposition that it would certainly be easier to prove arranging prostitution, and the either way, whether the defendant is compelling or arranging, the crime would be a Class 4 felony with 1 to 3 years, I believe.
What's one of the puzzling things about it is you have the same sentencing range for arranging and compelling, yet you'd think compelling was worse than arranging, unless compelling doesn't require much compulsion. So that's why I'm puzzled.
Your Honor, it is a, you know, in some respects a puzzling statute in the sense that it wasn't as kind of artfully drafted as it could have been. I think the you know, that's reflected in legislature's now insertion of a mental element. But in terms of why the statute would have a compulsion element and an arranging element, I mean, one, we don't know from the legislative history, but one reason may be that, of course, if you do have a case where someone has, where you can prove compulsion and you can prove the type of compulsion that involves force or putting a gun to someone's head, that maybe within the range of a Class 4 felony, you could, you know, have a judicial fact finding, which would.
That's true, but you also have additional crimes.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct.
Charging with something else,
right?
And you use the word force, but that isn't what they use, because that bothers me. As far as if whatever you want to call them, pimp or somebody, forces a woman, you know, takes advantage of her, she maybe have compelling reasons, which seem to be things whether they need the money or
right.
they're runaways or there's something that has some other feature that they got to have, they got to do this. That may be one compulsion. And the other is when they're basically a slave. Somebody's captured them, they're feeding them and saying, you've got to do this. And that's worse. That's force. And I don't even know what the underlying facts here. I sort of heard they were that.
Your Honor, to your first point, certainly a type of force in the 1900s when the statute, the federal statutes out of which this one kind of and all other pandering statutes emanated did kind of have in mind a kind of, at least factually in the background, some kind of concubine type situation that would obviously be compulsion. But what's important here is that the Illinois General Assembly made clear that no longer is that the quintessential type of pandering, but rather it's a type of inducement, whether it's money or drugs that kind of compels.
What if you had a woman who was earning just the minimum wage, be about almost $300 a week, and then the panderer comes along and says, I'll pay you $1,000 a week. So she says, well, I really need the money, so I don't want to be a prostitute, but I need that extra $700. Would that be compulsion under this statute?
Yes, Your Honor, our position is that under this statute, if that woman was overborne because of financial destitution, she felt she had no kind of meaningful choice about whether to engage in prostitution, that would be sufficient. And it's important to note, Your Honors, in this case, that the government hasn't contested the proposition we make with respect to the intentional element of the compulsion prong. They say, Your Honor, that it's sufficient that another simply that the defendant simply have an intent that another person engage in prostitution. We submit in our briefs, and I can discuss and rebuttal why that is not sufficient to elevate this crime to an ACCA-worthy offense.
Well, of course, you're talking about crime of violence.
Yes, Your Honor.
Yeah, and so it seems the focus is on what could happen to the prostitute engaging with some third party who might injure her or it might be bad. And that seems to remove it from this compulsion.
And I
have a problem balancing that out. I say, well, the end result is where the violence could occur, which may well be true. And I suppose you need some sort of statistical analysis.
Your Honor, we would submit that we don't deny that the kind of risk of serious potential injury is a factor to be considered. But before the court gets there, our position is that it first has to determine whether the element of this crime, which would elevate it to an ACCA-worthy offense, which would entail 5 additional years in prison, is the purposeful, categorically purposeful crime. And only if it is, Your Honor.
Is that still required after Sykes?
Yes, Your Honor. Sykes, in our position is that Sykes is not to the contrary. Of course, it's important to note that in Sykes, the federal statute at issue there did have, as the new pandering statute does, an intentional mens rea written into the statute. It also dealt with intentional vehicle flight, which the Supreme Court, explained was akin to unleashing a violent force, and this court in its recent opinions has likened it to the use of a dangerous instrumentality. We submit that the vehicle flight at issue in Sykes was akin to brandishing a weapon in the way that the inducements at issue under the pandering statute are not. Your Honors, if there are no further questions, I'd like to save the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Ms. Carr. Ms. Mullen?
Good morning. May it please the Court, Linda Mullen on behalf of the United States. Wow, we've covered a lot of ground.
You can tell us something about this compulsion offense.
Well, I was just about to say we've covered a lot of ground here, and I'm trying to figure out, there have been so many questions that have been asked. Judge Posner, you posed the hypothetical, what if a panderer came up to a target and said, you're only making $300 a week, I'll give you $1,000 a week, would that be compulsion? And we would submit that that's a business arrangement being offered by the panderer to somebody who is...
Is that not compulsion?
We would say that's not compulsion. That still gives the target the opportunity to make an informed decision about what he or she wants to do.
What would minimal compulsion be?
Well, we would say compulsion involves coercion, getting someone to do something against their will.
That's just using the same word again. What is... Be concrete.
Do something against
like
their
what?
Will through threat
like
or force.
Minimal.
Well, in many compulsion situations, Judge Mannin, you asked about the underlying facts here. We have a situation where someone is physically forced.
No, but the legislative history says the principal concern is drugs.
Well, but again, the situation is whether or not you are driven to do something, or you are, I don't know how to say it without
forced.
Using adjectives, forced to do something by the panderer.
Well, so, if you're offered money, that's not compulsion. Now, what if you're offered drugs?
Well, I think if the person is addicted to drugs and that, you know, results in a situation where the person does feel forced to do it to feed the addiction.
But the person who needs the money may feel forced.
Well, I think that still entails more of it.
Maybe eating or feeding their children or something like that.
Well, I think that
it's hard to see the difference.
Right. I do think that, as this court pointed out in Brown 1, I guess we'll call it, that the compulsion aspect of the statute as opposed to the arranging aspect of the statute really deals with the relationship between the panderer and the target. Really,
look.
It is pre-begay.
What weight do you give to the fact that this compelling crime has a 3-year maximum, which is the same as the arranging crime? Doesn't that suggest like really tepid punishment for an ACCA enhancer?
Well, under the ACCA analysis, Your Honor, whether it's post-Begay, post-Sykes, whether Sykes changed the rule, we still look to see the risk of violence inherent in these offenses.
Is it comparable to burglary?
I think that the risk of violence here is actually more serious than it is with burglary.
So what do you think the maximum what do you think the maximum punishment is for residential burglary in Illinois?
I don't know what the maximum sentence is.
Well, I'll tell you, it's 15 years.
Well, but this deals with...
What do you think the maximum punishment is for residential arson in Illinois?
I don't know.
Also 15 years. Now, these are crimes mentioned in the, you know, ACCA. So you would think that a state crime to be comparable would carry a heavy sentence.
But that's not what Begay and Sykes counsel. Begay and Sykes counsel that we are to look to the risk inherent in those crimes.
We don't know anything about how Illinois interprets compelling. We know nothing. So we have to cast around. We could have statistics, which no one has presented, or we could look at how Illinois punishes other crimes, which we know are crimes of violence, because the difference in punishment might be a clue to how the state regards this crime, and in turn, what the crime is. And if they think compulsion is inducement, and so it only deserves a 3-year maximum, that would carry it pretty far away from a crime of violence.
Well, they may not have considered it to be as serious as other crimes, but the analysis...
What about drugs? So suppose you've got a woman who's a drug addict, and it's expensive, her habit, her addiction. So the... panderer says to her, well, look, I'll make it easy for you. I'll give you the drugs. Okay? You be a prostitute, give you the drugs. Now, is that compulsion?
I think it would depend on whether or not the person was forced into the situation.
What's your evidence that Illinois thinks it would depend? You haven't made any investigation whatsoever into the Illinois compulsion statute.
Well, I suppose the reason for that, Your Honor, is that we have an opinion from this court in Brown 1 that says pandering by compulsion is a violent felony.
Of course, that's pre-Begay.
It is pre-Begay and pre-Sykes, but there's nothing in the language of Begay or Sykes.
On that opinion?
Well,
look,
this is what we think.
We have to know something. Don't we have to know something about Illinois law?
Well, I think that what we need to do is look to see whether any language...
Why couldn't you go out and get evidence? I mean, you could talk to you know, people in law enforcement in Illinois. Say, what is this law about? Who do you prosecute? What's your, you know, conception of it? What's the average case? What if it turns out the average case of compelling, if there are any cases, is where, oh, yeah, these... The panderer offered her a really high increase in her wage, and she couldn't resist. Right? The offer was too good to turn down. Right? What if that's what their idea of compulsion?
Well, this
case dissolves, right?
Well, perhaps, but this
not perhaps, because you said at the beginning, just offering someone a nice raise is not compulsion.
Right. That's right. But in Brown 1, this court said...
Get Brown 1. I am bothered by giving this person enhancement without having any idea what this Illinois law requires in the way of compulsion.
Well, let's move then, Judge Posner, for a minute to the other conviction in play here, the armed violence conviction, because we don't just have, in our view...
This is armed violence because... He has a gun while he's consuming drugs?
While he's possessing cocaine,
yes. Possessing. Well, what's that about?
Well, possessing.
That's very different from selling drugs. If you sell drugs and you're armed, you know, that obviously that's a potentially dangerous situation. That's what you're armed. If you just happen to be sitting in your living room smoking marijuana and you have a gun in your house... That's a crime of violence?
Well, generally, the reason that people have a gun when they're possessing drugs is so that they have...
Americans have guns, right?
But we're talking about...
How many Americans have guns? What percentage of the population? You don't know that either. Okay. But a lot of people have guns. Many of them smoke marijuana, right? Because many millions of people smoke marijuana, many millions of people have guns, and these two groups overlap considerably. So you're saying that every time a person is smoking marijuana and he has a gun in his house, he's committing a crime of violence?
We don't have to show that every single time the person is committing a crime of violence. What we have to show is in the typical scenario that would be a crime of violence.
Now, what makes you think it's typical for marijuana smokers who own guns to become violent, or somehow having the gun and smoking the marijuana, how does that become a crime?
It's generally, if people are going to possess a gun along with drugs, they are possessing that gun as a means to protect their supply.
There's a big difference between the drug consumers in the tens of millions and the drug dealers. The drug dealers are engaged in a very dangerous trade, and they're armed for purposes of protecting themselves as drug dealers. But the ordinary person who happens to have a gun and happens to be a consumer of drugs, what's the reason to think that his possession of a gun makes him likely to be violent?
Because that person is still an integral part of the drug trade. It may be at the end of the transaction.
Completely wrong. Because you seem to think that every drug consumer in the United States is somehow at risk of violence or likely to commit violence because he's engaged in illegal conduct. That must be your idea. You have some evidence for that?
Well, I don't believe... It's not our position that... Our position is that anyone who is possessing guns and drugs, the reason they're possessing the gun, the typical situation would be to protect their supply.
No, because most people don't have guns because of drugs. They have guns. They love guns. It's America. They love guns. or it's for self-protection or target practice or what have you. They have guns, and maybe they also smoke marijuana along with tens of millions of other people.
We're talking about
that doesn't mean that they're likely that they're violent because they have a gun.
Well, we're talking about the combination of the two, and this court has said repeatedly.
The combination is the overlap between the drug consumers and the gun owners. And that's very different from being in the drug business or in the gun business.
Well, we submit that if you're a possessor of drugs, you are part of that illegal drug trade, even if it's at the end.
I think that's ridiculous, I have to say, because it's just so unrealistic. You must know people who smoke marijuana, right?
Wow.
Of course you do. How many people smoke marijuana in the
United
States?
Prosecutor Judge Posner.
And there's this huge movement to legalize it, because it's recognized that it's just an extremely common habit, and most of the people who smoke marijuana, for that matter, most of the people who snort cocaine and abuse prescription drugs and on and on and on, they're not violent people, and they're just consumers, and a lot of them have guns, not because they take drugs, but because a lot of Americans have guns. And to say somehow that if you happen to smoke marijuana and you own a gun, that's a crime of violence.
Could I interject something here? Incidentally, I lost that end user of aiding and abetting a long time ago. So just possession and a gun, it's far-fetched. I want to go back to the compulsion.
Mm-hmm.
Because it seemed to me you were focused on the, you call them target, what you call them?
Target. I wouldn't call it a prostitute.
What
because
she
don't,
would no. might encounter with the third-party customer. And that's
right.
Where the potential violence was potentially occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been focusing on all that beforehand, because if we looked at the underlying facts here, we'd probably find this guy was kind of violent.
Well, that's right. If you look at the look at the criminal history, you see as this court said
and,
in the first
instance.
And when
we look at that, we're not looking at that. And maybe this was pleaded down to something worse, from something worse. And this is, and so I think it comes down to whether or not there is enough potential risk out there for this target to make this a crime of violence.
That's absolutely right. We couldn't agree more.
And I think Judge Posner distinguishes the penalty compared to burglary, where there is that potential, versus this, it kind of minimizes that argument. And that's why because that's where this whole thing is focused, frankly.
I feel like I've found
We're not allowed to look at the facts of this case, are we?
Well, no, but we can look at the typical situation where we have...
all the typical situation. Apparently this crime is not enforced. This is some freak case. because the state obviously prefers the arranging offense. It has the same punishment range, and it's much easier to prove. So they prefer that. There's almost no cases. So we don't know what the typical case is. And you, the U.S. Attorney, the Justice Department, has not bothered to make any inquiry into what exactly this offense is. How is it treated by law enforcement in Illinois? Why does it have this very low maximum sentence? Right? Those are investigatable issues. You know, the Supreme Court in the Chambers case, it was disturbed by the fact that that was the case about whether a walkaway escape is a crime of violence, and they're bothered by the fact that no one bothers to present evidence. In fact, there were Justice Department statistics which showed that violence was very rare with these walkaway escapes. Here, we don't have anything. We don't have any evidence.
Well, and the Sykes court made clear that statistics can be helpful, but they're certainly not necessary. And in this case, it seems to us to be common sense that when you have someone forcing someone else...
No, it's not common sense, because if this were really, focused on physical force, you wouldn't have a 3-year maximum.
You didn't have a charge, which you wouldn't have, because if this had come out that he... whatever did force her, she mm-hmm. was trapped, couldn't go anywhere else, et cetera, and there is force and violence. That's your violence. But that wouldn't be charged then. That would be some other charge.
Well, but there are lesser. There are ways to be aggressive and violent that don't include a prolonged holding of somebody against their will. I mean, there's.
But you focused on the target's encounter with the third party as where the violence might occur.
Well, we believe, Judge Manning,
that makes it a crime of violence.
Yes, that
only that.
That certainly does make it a crime of violence. The potential for
that's what we have to decide. I think.
What's the third party? I don't understand.
The user,
the John, the patron.
She's beating him up or what?
He's beating her up.
Well, it could go either way, right? I think is maybe Judge Posner's point. But is your question is there a violent encounter? Is there a potential for violent encounter between the compelled prostitute and the
right.
John or the patron? Absolutely. And
absolutely.
Yes.
And
is there a risk of that? Absolutely.
You have statistics on that?
Well, no. But when you're talking, Your Honor, about two people in a intimate situation where one of them is vulnerable, one of them has been compelled to engage in this, there's going to be a power imbalance in that.
Vulnerable.
And it's very common for it. No, and have I cited statistics in the brief? No, I'd be happy to file. I'm sorry?
I don't think there are those statistics.
Well, we looked extensively for those, and I did find law review articles that cite to statistics with respect to...
I've looked at those law review articles.
To certain cities and things, but not necessarily nationwide.
Very poor. This is a very under-researched area.
The violence with prostitution? Yeah. I mean, that's definitely what we found. But I do think that in some situations it's a matter of common sense. And when you have someone being forced into the situation of committing a sexual act...
So then you probably think pimping is a crime of violence, too.
No, I don't think pimping is a crime of
violence. Well, why not?
Well,
promotes prostitution. You say prostitution promotes violence.
Do you mean I think the...
For some reason, Illinois has these three separate crimes, compelling, arranging prostitution, and pimping.
Mm-hmm.
Well, on your theory, pimping is a crime of violence, too.
If what we mean by pimping, someone's arranging for two people to come together.
What is your understanding of being a pimp?
Well, you didn't define it, but if that's what you mean, then I would say that that's not necessarily.
Pimp?
I think a pimp is someone who arranges for someone
Why isn't pimping also a crime of violence?
I think that there's a difference in the relationship between the pimp and the target in that situation. When you have someone coming to someone else and saying, are you interested in doing this? Are you willing to do this? I think that's different than compelling somebody to engage in something where they can be put into a very dangerous situation and don't have the ability to make that risk analysis for themselves.
But the pimp who goes to a woman and says, or would be an arranging panderer who says, look, I'll pay you a lot more if you become a prostitute for me. Now, on your theory, that's a crime of violence because if she becomes a prostitute, she's endangering herself.
I think he's promoting
violence by recruiting her.
I think that there's a difference when in that situation the target or the prostitute would always have the ability then to say, no, this particular situation is not one that I want to go into. Overall, I've agreed to work for you for money.
But the violence arises out of the encounter with the customer, the client. And so the violence is the same as to both. I don't see how
that would be different. Well, the violence is, there's a potential for violence there, but there's not this compelled action. And so prostitute, you could make a decision in a given situation.
What's a given situation?
Well, in a particular circumstance,
This
is not a John I am interested in going with. There's something creepy about him. I don't like where he wants to take me. I don't like the feel of this. Whereas someone who is compelled is not making that kind of decision in a particular case. That person has relinquished or has had their will relinquished to somebody else, and I think that the chances of that resulting in a violent encounter are higher than if somebody can use their own judgment and intuition to make a particular decision. So that's not to say that I mean, obviously, in prostitution cases, there's violence inherent in the trade, and that can happen whether or not, you know, someone is compelled or not compelled. But we're looking at, if we look at the Begay factors, which, of course, the Supreme Court tiptoed away from in Sykes when it's not a crime of strict liability, but the purposefulness is here, the aggressiveness is here in the compelling part of it, in the coercion part of it, and the violence speaks to the risk of violence in these situations. So whether we're looking at it under a risk analysis approach post-Sykes or even the test proposed by Begay, we would submit that this is a crime of violence.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Mullen.
You.
Ms. Cox?
Your Honors, the government spoke about the potential for violence at the kind of end of this offense, that is to say the actual sex act or the prostitution. And we submit that is not a sufficient risk, even if the court does decide to take a risk-based analysis. And that's for a couple of reasons. First, it would indeed encompass arranging a situation in which one could prostitute. That would qualify as an ACCA offense. And we submit that just can't be the type of offense that Congress had in mind that would be kind of subject to substantial penalties under ACCA. The other reason, Your Honor, why that risk is not sufficient is, of course, even under Sykes and even under the government's reading of Sykes in their brief, if this is not an intentional crime in the way envisaged by Begay, then the court doesn't go just to the risk levels assessment. And so we submit, Your Honors, that you first must ask whether this is an intentional crime, and we submit that it's not. We would also add, Your Honors, that the government acknowledges in their brief that it is their burden to establish that the crimes here were sufficiently predicates to qualify as ACCA offenses, and they have not done so in this case. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we submit that this court should vacate Mr. Brown's ACCA enhanced sentence. We'd also note, Your Honors, that in Fife, this court's first decision in Fife, the armed violence conviction does not count as a violent felony because, as this court noted and Judge Posner mentioned earlier, the mere possession of drugs, even cocaine, as was at issue in this case, is not sufficient to render a crime a violent felony under the ACCA's residual clause. If there are no further questions, Your Honor, we'd ask that you vacate Mr. Brown's enhanced sentence.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Cox. And you were appointed, were you not?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you very much for your efforts on behalf of you. And we certainly thank Ms. Mullen for standing up against verbal violence from the bench. So.